Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the NAREIT REIT Report podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Borks from Quito, and today we're discussing the latest developments surrounding Opportunity Zones. My guest today is Dan King, Senior Manager of National Tax Services at Cohen Resnick. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Sarah.
Now, Opportunity Zones were created back in 2017 by the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Has the intervening time, as well as the final regulations that came out at the end of 2019, created greater clarity and confidence for investors and other interested parties?
Yeah, the final regulations have answered a lot of the uncertainties in the market. The service has been very receptive to comments and feedback and has incorporated a lot of it into the final regulations. They originally issued two proposed regulation packages and allowed time for commentary. And obviously, they received a lot of commentary from people in the market. And they did a really good job of incorporating a lot of it. There's a lot of taxpayer-friendly aspects in the regulations. For example, originally, the proposed regulations only allowed net 1231 gains to be invested. So investors had to wait until the end of the tax year to know if they had a net gain. But now the final regulations allow gross 1231 gains to be invested, and they can be invested within 180 days of the gain recognition. So it's very taxpayer friendly. And that was one of the uncertainties stemming from the proposed regulations that, you know, a lot of commenters wanted some guidance on, and hopefully favorable guidance, and we got that in the final regulations. Also, the proposed regulations included a 31-month safe harbor period for working capital. That's the period in which working capital in the form of cash and short-term debt instruments would not be considered non-qualified financial property. In other words, a bad asset for qualified opportunity zone purposes. The final regulations added a new 62-month safe harbor period for certain startup businesses, which is a very helpful provision for startup businesses to get off the ground. So again, a very taxpayer-friendly addition in the final regulations. And again, I'm here just hitting some of the highlights here. There's a lot in the final regulations, but I'm only going to be able to cover some of the highlights here. And another very good taxpayer benefit is that a qualified opportunity zone business that's located in one opportunity zone can have operations across several other opportunity zones, and the operations can all be treated as one qualified opportunity zone business. You wouldn't need separate qualified opportunity zone businesses or qualified opportunity funds in each one of the different zones. It could all be treated as one, as long as the activities in other qualified opportunity zones. So, you know, we understand that the government's kind of moving at light speed trying to get this guidance out. The opportunity zone program was somewhat unexpected, and it, it's a very complicated program. It needs a lot of guidance. And, you know, the IRS, we understand, is moving as fast as possible to address a lot of this. And obviously, the market demands are much greater because people are really interested in the program and interested in doing deals. And, you know, a lot of this guidance is really needed. But I think overall, the government's doing a very good job considering all the complexity and issues that need to be addressed. And just to get, it goes to show that, you know, the final regulation package came in at 544 pages. Now, only 200 pages of that were actual regulations. The other 354 pages, roughly, were all explanatory preamble, just explaining, you know, what the proposed regs said and addressing a lot of the commentary that the service received in the interim period. And they really went into depth explaining all the different commentaries and why, you know, some things they didn't adopt and other things they did, and explaining why that is. So, you know, it just goes to show that the explanation is greater than the regulations themselves in terms of page count. So that really goes to show that the IRS is very receptive to taxpayer comments and suggestions. There's still some aspects that need to be clarified, and hopefully that'll be clarified with additional guidance going forward. One thing is just the working capital requirement for the 70% tangible property standard. It's not really clear if that applies or not, but you know, things like that I'm sure will be addressed in the future. But again, overall, I think the final rate package has been very well received by the industry. And we've seen a lot more activity now. We're getting a lot more questions coming in, and a lot more people are interested in doing deals and now have that guidance that they really needed to understand how to implement the rules.
And that really leads into my next question, which is, how would you describe the types of investors being drawn to opportunity zones? And what are you expecting in terms of new entrants into the market?
Well, we see a lot of family offices, a lot of real estate developers, a lot of closely held businesses. These are just some of the investors that we see looking into opportunity zones. We see a lot of family offices teaming up with developers. The family office may have the capital to invest. They may have the capital gain. And they want to team up with a developer that has a lot of experience in the real estate industry, particularly in that geographic area within opportunity zones. And these developers may already have some real estate deals in the pipeline. Some of them may have just been sitting on the sidelines waiting to try to find investment capital. And now, because of the opportunity zone, that capital is now there, and so it can really accelerate some of the real estate deals that are already in the pipeline. So again, the opportunity zone program is really providing that influx of capital. And we're advising a lot of investors and developers that you still want to do good deals. You still want to do a deal that you would otherwise do even without the opportunity zone program. You don't want to do something just to get the opportunity zone benefits. We tell investors, particularly, these are still investments that you want to really vet for the long term, and not just jump into something just to get the tax deferrals that are under the program. The investment should be a good one and be evaluated on criteria, not considering the opportunity zone benefits by themselves. But generally, the best investors in opportunity zones are the ones with long-term investment goals. REITs and family offices are really good examples. So we're expecting to see even more of this going forward in the future.
Now, you mentioned REITs. How would you characterize the approach REITs have taken to opportunity zones? And where do you see that heading in the next few years?
Well, what we see a lot is private REITs. Private REITs tend to have better control over cash reinvestment, so they may be better positioned than public REITs to take advantage of the opportunity zones. So we've been seeing a lot of interest from private REITs. They may be in a better position to move quickly on opportunity zone investment opportunities. Again, particularly these ones that might be already in the pipeline, just waiting for investment capital. But REITs can really benefit from having flexibility under the program in terms of what level the investment can be made. The investment could be made by the operating partnership, or it could be made by the REIT itself, or those capital gains can be pushed out to shareholders who can make the investment. So it's really beneficial for REITs because you have this, you can have some flexibility in what level you make the opportunity zone investment. And then obviously whoever is in either the OP or the shareholders in the REIT or particular shareholders can benefit from the investment. So it really does give a lot of flexibility.
And is it possible to get a sense of the amount of capital going into the opportunity zone marketplace right now?
Well, there's definitely a lot of transactions going on. And I believe that the government is accumulating and tracking the data to eventually evaluate how the program is being used. We're now past the first year of tax returns. It would be the 2018 tax year. And so those returns have been filed now going up until the fall of 2019. So now the government has a lot more data in terms of what types of taxpayers are doing the investments and how much those investments are. So I think at some point we're going to see data coming out from the service or from Treasury as to how the program is being utilized and get an idea of what the total amount of capital is. But it's probably going to be pretty significant. The Opportunity Zone program was originally budgeted for about $1.5 billion of cost to the government, but it's likely going to be much higher when we see this play out, because we've been seeing a lot of deals that range between, say, 5 and 15 million. Some deals I've heard maybe as high as $500 million. But commonly, a common size deal may have, let's say, $5 million of acquisition costs and maybe $10 million of development costs. And so you figure, given the volume of the program across all these geographic areas where the opportunity zones are, it really is going to add up, and it could be a very significant investment. But I think at this point, we're going to have to wait to see how that data turns out once the government accumulates it and starts to really evaluate the program.
And from a geographic perspective, where do you expect to see the most activity and opportunity zones?
We see urban zones being used a lot more than rural zones. Also, big sites tend to provide the largest opportunities. A lot of times, the urban zones will have more appeal for development, given the proximity to resources like public transportation and maybe other amenities. Also, a lot of times, urban environments will have a closer mix of residential and commercial properties. So, whether you're doing a residential deal and you want to provide housing for people that have work opportunities nearby, or vice versa, maybe it's commercial that you want to have people living close by, urban centers tend to be more conducive to that residential commercial mix. We don't see many rural developments. There's maybe a few. I think there was a agricultural deal out in California that was being considered. It was an orchard where the investment property was going to be the orchard trees, which would be depreciable and eligible property. So those are probably few and far between, but generally we see a lot more urban areas being considered. As far as geographic location, a lot of these developments are on the East Coast or the West Coast, in major metropolitan areas. We're looking at cities like Boston, New York, Washington, D.C. On the West Coast, cities like L.A., San Diego, San Francisco. Again, those tend to be the primary areas that have the most opportunity for these developments. And again, a lot of these areas already have real estate development deals kind of being planned or in the pipeline. So that really helps move them forward and start accelerating once that investment capital is available because of the Opportunity Zone program. Those deals really start accelerating quickly.
And finally, Dan, what else are you likely to be watching in this space going forward?
Well, I think from a regulatory standpoint, definitely disclosure requirements I think are going to be evolving over time. Like I mentioned, I think the government's going to be evaluating the effectiveness of the program and accumulating a lot of data, and that data that they want to accumulate may change over time based on the trends that they see. So right now, taxpayers have to complete tax form 8996 with their tax return. And this form provides a lot of information on things like, the type of taxpayer, whether the Qualified Opportunity Zone fund is a partnership or a corporation, the value of the investment, and what Opportunity Zone the investment is in based on the tract number of that area. So this provides the government with a lot of information for tracking where the qualified property is and where people are investing. So I feel like more than likely this form may change over time, may evolve as the government starts to do their preliminary assessments of how effective the program is and how people are using it. So we may see, you know, additional reporting requirements and additional information that, you know, the government's going to use to track it. And I think it would be very interesting to see the trends as hopefully the data is released to see where the program's going. And this may change people's perspective on where they want to invest, how much they want to invest, and things like that. So, and also, you know, a big unknown is the political aspect of it. You know, a change in administration may change the rules somewhat and maybe expand it or contract it. And it's kind of an unknown based on this preliminary data where the program is going to go. But, yeah, it definitely seems like it might be a situation where it's going to be evolving over time. So I think we'll just have to sit back and wait and see how it goes.
Dan, thank you so much for spending time with the REIT Report today.
Thank you, Sarah.
And to our listeners, if you enjoyed today's podcast, please be sure to leave a review or subscribe on iTunes. And for more information on REITs, be sure to visit REIT.com.